Some of you weren't alive when the Apollo 13 mission began. It was the sixth mission to the moon. And James Lovell, Jack Swigert, Fred Hayes were the crew members. And there's been a fairly recent movie about Apollo 13 that you might have seen. If not, you should see it because it was Dorothy and I don't go to the movies very often, but this is one that's worthwhile. But on April the 13th, 1970, 55 hours and 54 minutes into this mission to the moon, it was the sixth one, as I said, Lovell, the commander, heard a loud bang. And at first, he said, he thought Swigert was playing a prank, because occasionally Swigert would take a wrench or something metal and whang it on the side of the capsule, with make a loud bang and scare the crew half to death, and then he'd start laughing. Well, that's what he thought had happened. But then immediately after that, multiple master caution warnings began going off on the control panels. And then Lovell looked outside. They had very small little windows, about that big, looked outside, and he saw some gas venting into space and some debris. He initially thought it was a meteor strike. Then Swigert famously said, as he got on the radio, he said, "Houston, we have a problem here." Very famous words. Unknown to them, they were trying to figure out what was going on, but unknown to them, oxygen tank 2 had just exploded. And during that explosion, it damaged oxygen tank number 1. And what Lovell saw out his window was their oxygen supply venting out into space. But their depleting levels of oxygen wasn't their only problem, because that explosion created a shortage of water and a shortage of electricity. Because you see, the Apollo created electricity and water in a fuel cell, an onboard fuel cell, by combining oxygen from the tanks and hydrogen from other tanks. They would combine them and generate electricity and water. And without oxygen, which was leaking out into space, they had no way to manufacture air to breathe, no way to manufacture water, and they would lose power. All of which, any one of those three would mean their death. Now, at the time, they were 20,000 miles from Earth heading in the wrong direction. And they were doing so at several thousand miles an hour. Not a good situation. Swigert said afterwards, he said, quote, "If somebody had thrown that at us in the simulator," meaning quadruple failures of fuel cells 1 and 3 and oxygen tanks 1 and 2, "we would have said, come on, you're not being realistic." And yet that's exactly what happened. So they had an immediate crisis, and they had to do everything possible to conserve oxygen and water and, most importantly, electricity. So what they did is they immediately transferred from the command module, that's that pyramid, conical-shaped capsule with a heat shield on the bottom, and then the service module was down below containing the area where the explosion occurred. They transferred into the lunar module, commonly called the LEM. And the LEM was that they had earlier taken the LEM out of the service module and put it attached to the nose of the command module. And the LEM is that spidery-looking craft that was going to be used to go down to the moon. And so immediately they transferred themselves from the command module into this lunar module. They later called it their lifeboat. The LEM was designed to take 2 men down to the moon, while the third one orbited the moon in the command module. And then the LEM would come back to the command module, and then they would head home. The LEM, the spidery-looking device, this craft, was built to sustain 2 men for 40 hours. Now it had to sustain 3 men for 4 days. And how do you do that? That was one of the crises. So all non-essential systems were shut down, including heat. and all electrical systems in the command module were shut down. This had never happened before in space, but they shut everything down in the command module, and then they moved into the lunar module. And as a result of shutting down their electricity, remember, they're in outer space, the temperature in the lunar module came down to 38 degrees. And they're wearing their very thin flight suits. They don't have parkas up on their way to the moon. And so it began to get very, very cold. And because they had limited water supply, they were rationed. They made the decision to ration themselves one little small cup of water per day. And as a result of that, over the next few days, they became dehydrated. And if you've ever been dehydrated, I have. It affects your concentration. It affects your mental clarity. And so they had to deal with that. Now, the only viable way home was them to continue onto the moon and swing around the far side and use the moon's gravity to help propel them back to Earth. And that's exactly what they did. They passed over the lunar surface 137 miles up on they're doing a big 180 on the way back to Earth. But here's the problem. With all the electricity shut off, they could not navigate electronically. And they couldn't navigate by the stars. They were trained to do that. They had the equipment to do that. But the problem is, when that explosion occurred, all the debris from the explosion was following the spaceship. Little pieces of insulation and metal and all of that. And so it was just hanging with the spaceship, and there was no way they could tell that from the stars. And so they could not navigate by the stars. And the fact is, to come back to Earth, they had to hit a very precise window coming back into the Earth's atmosphere. If they hit it too shallow, they would bounce off the atmosphere and just go into outer space. If they hit it too big a descent, they would burn up. And so they devised a way whereby Lovell looked out one window and put the moon by the thrusters, put the moon in a certain part of that window, and then looked out this window and put the Earth, a portion of the Earth, in that part of that window. And I mean, he's using thrusters and trying to do all of this to get them lined up. And if he could get it lined up and get it stable, that would be the correct path. And he was able to do that. Then they fired a burn for a number of seconds to get them back, to speed their way back to Earth before they lost water, air, power, and all of that. And so on their way back to Earth, they had a real problem, and that was that carbon dioxide was building up in the atmosphere of the LEM. They were slowly being poisoned by their own breath. Because we take in oxygen, we exhale carbon dioxide. Plants do the exact opposite. But there were no plants up there. And say that, so they were slowly being poisoned. But they had filters in the LEM that would filter out the carbon dioxide. But remember, the LEM was only designed for two guys for 40 hours. And so those filters quickly became full. They came up with a brilliant idea that there's filters in the command module, so let's go get those, which they did. There was only one problem. The openings to the filters in the lunar module were round, and the openings to the filters in the command module were square. And Gene Kranz, the mission controller, he was the head mission controller for the whole operation, who had earlier famously said to the ground crew trying to pump them up, he said, failure is not an option. And that's a common phrase today. But when he saw square hole, round hole, and it's not working, the astronauts are up saying up there, this isn't going to work, Grant said, tell me this isn't a government operation. And so what he did is he got a room, and he put the filters in the room, and he said, get me everything they have up in space, everything, paper, manuals. Thankfully, they had even some duct tape, and they had everything. And he said to the scientists there, you make this work, and he gave them a time limit because they were going to die. And they dumped all this stuff on the table, and they started working. And these engineers found a way to put a square peg in a round hole, And they did it with cardboard and duct tape. Duct tape solves a lot of problems, as most of us know. And so once they did, then the carbon dioxide levels began to reduce, and they began to breathe easier. And as they approached their reentry to the Earth, they had to climb back into the command module from their little limb lifeboat, because the limb couldn't land on Earth. They jettisoned the limb, and it later burned up in the Earth's atmosphere. But they went into the command module, and the only electricity they had were the batteries that they had saved in the command module. Now, they had to have a brand new power-up procedure because they couldn't overstress those batteries. And if they did the normal power-up procedure, they'd blow the batteries out in a matter of seconds. So they had to devise, which they had done in simulators down on Earth, a power-up procedure that would was in the capabilities of the batteries, but that would power up just enough for them to turn the craft around so that the heat shield was facing the Earth, power the thrusters, a little bit of communication. And this had never been tried before. And to complicate matters, because of the drop in temperature, the control panels had condensation all over them to the point that water was dripping off the panels down on the floor. And it would be like you pouring water into the keyboard of your laptop and then trying to start your laptop. That was what they faced. And they knew that when they threw that first switch, if they had a short, their lives were over. But, God has mercy on whom He has mercy. And I believe sometimes God just intervenes out of mercy. And they threw the switch, and everything started powering up. And re-entry would only be successful if that angle was correct. We talked about earlier that the heat shield wasn't damaged from this explosion. They had no way of knowing. And if the parachutes worked, if they weren't damaged somehow. And I can remember the entire world was watching. And the fact is they successfully landed back on Earth 4 days after that explosion. And it shows you how fragile life was up in that spacecraft. And if things weren't properly balanced, how they would die very quickly. So why am I telling you this story? What does this have to do with the sermon on the Sabbath? Well, the point is, this Earth is very much like that spacecraft. The astronauts could only survive this fragile craft if the precise balance of various factors worked, and they were all in balance. Otherwise, they would die. And the same is true for this Earth. There are various factors that come together to allow life on this Earth, and we can only survive if all of those are in correct balance. And if conditions on the spacecraft went awry, which they obviously did very dramatically, the astronauts were going to die. And the fact is, on this Earth, if the conditions on the Earth, the parameters that lead to life, if they vary only a tiny little bit, life would not be possible on the Earth. And so, you see, to support a spacecraft such as the Apollo 13, they found out that environment has to be finely tuned for them to survive. And here is the point. The same is true for here on Earth. Our environment has to be finely tuned for life to exist on Earth. For us to remain alive, nothing can change very, very much. Nothing can change by any huge degree, or life will not be possible. Now here's, with that in mind, now let's understand that today, many, many scientists, there's been a shift in the scientific community. Many, many scientists are coming to believe that the universe began from nothing. We call that the Big Bang. I gave a sermon on that back in March of this year, that there was a time when nothing existed, no time, no matter, no energy, and it came into existence at one point with a gigantic explosion. And scientists resisted that for decades. But let me quote John Lennox. He's a PhD and professor of mathematics at Oxford University. He's not a dummy. In his book, God and Stephen Hawking, he says, quote, "Even if non-believers don't like it," meaning non-believers in the Big Bang, "the Big Bang resonates powerfully with the biblical narrative of creation. That is why, before the Big Bang gained currency, so many leading scientists were keen to dismiss it, since it seemed to support the biblical story." But today, you see, particularly the last 30 to 50 years, the evidence of the Big Bang is so overwhelming that it is now universally accepted as true by the vast majority of scientists on this earth. So many scientists have come to believe and understand there was a time that there was nothing and something came out of nothing. The second thing they're coming to understand is what we talked about in the beginning, is that the universe is finely tuned to support life here on Earth. The entire universe is finely tuned to support life here on Earth. And that understanding began with Sir Isaac Newton. He was born in 1642 and he died in 1727. And he is generally regarded as the most original and influential theorist in the history of science. He is on a pedestal that few can even come close to. And here is what he said, quote, "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion from an intelligent and powerful being," end quote. He understood that the balance that we have and the life that exists could only come from someone far superior to the human beings. Then 100 years later, William Paley, who was a theologian and a naturalist, wrote a book in 1818. And he posited finding a watch in the woods. We talked about this in that sermon a while back. So you're walking through the woods and the leaves and the trees and the flowing water, and you see this diamond-studded Rolex watch just lying on the floor of the forest. And he asked the question, is it logical to conclude that the watch came to be because of the wind and the rain? And then he said, is it logical to conclude that the watch came to be because of some chemical reaction in the soil? Or that the watch came to be because of some form of erosion? And then he concluded, he was fairly lengthy in this explanation, but he concluded this, quote, "The watch must have had a maker. Every indication of contrivance, every manifestation of design which exists in the watch exists in the work of nature, with the difference on the side of nature in a degree that exceeds all computation." Meaning something as complicated as the earth, with all of the factors that come together to make the earth as we know it, is so much more finely tuned than a mere watch. Therefore, if there had to be a designer for the watch, there must be a designer for the earth and all that goes into making this earth, including life on this earth. And yet, despite overwhelming evidence that God exists, there are those who deny this fact. They support evolution, and they find ways to try to get around this obvious evidence. And we know that they are influenced by Satan, and Satan wants mankind to believe that everything we see, everything we experience, has come together by accident or by chance. So what we want to do today in the balance of the sermon, this is all introduction, what we want to look today is examine the fact that one needs extreme faith to be an atheist, because the evidence is not on your side. Therefore, if you're going to be an atheist, you just have to have blind faith. And we're going to talk about that today. So first thing we want to do, we talked about these constants that must not vary to keep life on the earth as we know it. Let's look at just six of them. Finely tuned constants, which are required for life to exist. They're fairly obvious, but maybe sometimes we haven't thought about them. And this is true whether it's a spacecraft or whether it's on this earth. And we're going to apply the logic that God has given human beings to discern truth from falsehood. Okay, if you like to outline, this would be A, the first one, the level of oxygen in our atmosphere. On Earth, oxygen comprises 21% of air. What would happen if oxygen was 25%? Just 25%, just a few percentage points more. If that was the case, fire would erupt spontaneously over the earth. And it would burn and burn until all forms of life were burned up. Plant life, animal life. Couldn't exist if oxygen was just a few percentage points higher. On the other hand, what would happen if oxygen was just 15% instead of 21, just 15%? Human beings will suffocate. And the astronauts on the Apollo capsule were finding that out firsthand very quickly. So we see here oxygen is 21%, a little bit more or a little bit less, and everything goes away. Finely tuned indeed. And the ground crew in Houston and the Apollo astronauts had to find a way very quickly to keep that oxygen level at 21%, or they would die in just a matter of hours. B, the second one, the level of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. You know, carbon dioxide is only 0.04% of our atmosphere. And yet, if the CO2, carbon dioxide, was just a little bit higher, we would have runaway greenhouse effect in this atmosphere, and we would burn up with the heat if CO2 levels went up just a little bit. And, of course, there's great controversy today and around the world about these CO2 levels. Now, what would happen if the CO2 levels were a little bit less? If CO2 levels were less, we would be unable to sustain photosynthesis. The plants would die, and if the plants die, humans die because we would suffocate because they take in carbon dioxide and put out oxygen, and we would die because there's not enough oxygen. Again, the Apollo 13 astronauts found this out very quickly, very dramatically. C, the third point, the transparency of our atmosphere. And I mean by that, there's two factors. The thickness of our atmosphere, how high it goes up from the surface of the Earth, and also the clarity of our atmosphere. Because you look at Jupiter, you can't see anything past the clouds that are just boiling in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter. So the thickness, thinness, and the clarity of the atmosphere. If our atmosphere was less transparent, meaning cloudy, filled with dust and all of that, or if it was thicker, not enough of the sun's energy would reach the earth, and humans and plants would ultimately freeze to death. If, on the other hand, our atmosphere was thinner or more transparent, we would die in one of three ways. The nuclear radiation from the sun would cook us because the atmosphere filters that out and we don't have to worry about that. That's why on the Apollo spacecraft they have shielding because they're above the atmosphere. They have shielding to prevent that from happening. Or if our atmosphere was thinner or totally clear, we would roast to death from the heat. Or if it was thinner, we would have a serious problem with meteor strikes on the Earth because the vast majority, 99% of the meteors that strike the Earth burn up in the atmosphere. But if the atmosphere was thinner, we would have fires, we would have catastrophes all over the Earth. And as I said, the Apollo spacecraft had shielding to prevent that, but they rotated it along its long axis just like the Earth rotates, so that each side of the spacecraft got the same amount of exposure to the sun for heat purposes. Extremely fine-tuned, this Earth. Point D, the fourth. The gravitational interaction between the moon and the Earth. Well, you know, we kind of take that for granted. But what if that changed? You know, the Earth is 239,000 miles, give or take a few, from the Earth. And today, the lunar gravity in some parts of the Earth can cause tides of up to 60 feet. Now, what if the moon was closer to the Earth? In other words, the gravitational interaction between the Earth and the moon was much, much greater. Enormous tides would submerge all the lowlands all over the Earth twice a day. Life would be impossible in that area. And the air stirred up by these tides coming and going, these gigantic tides coming and going twice a day, the atmosphere would be so stirred up we would have daily hurricanes. And again, life would be almost impossible. Now, what would happen if the moon was farther away? The moon had less influence over the Earth. Well, that would cause orbital changes, scientists have calculated, that would cause dramatic instabilities in the atmosphere if that were to occur. But in either case, too close, too far away, life wouldn't exist. It is just right. Again, extremely fine-tuned. Point E, the force of gravity itself. Gravity is a constant. The force of gravity is a constant. So you have to ask yourself, okay, well, what if gravity was altered by 10%? Or what if it was altered by 1%? Or what if it was altered by 0.1%? In any of those cases, life would not exist. But Jeffrey Zwierink, he's a research physicist at UCLA, calculated that if gravity was altered by 0.1 with 37 zeros behind it, 0.1, that's a tenth, but 37 zeros behind it, if it was altered by that just that amount, the sun would float away. Gravity would not hold us together. Therefore, if we have no sun, we have no us. Extremely fine-tuned, this force of gravity. The last one we'll talk about, point F, the sixth, is the tilt of the Earth's axis. The sun rotates on its axis, and the Earth does too, but our axis is tilted 23 degrees, exactly 23 degrees. And so in the summertime, those of us in the northern hemisphere, we're facing the sun, so it is warmer. We come around to the fall, and it's equal. And then we come into winter, we're tilted away from the sun, and therefore we have winter. So this gives us our seasons, as we obviously know. What if the axes were identical, just like this? There was no tilt at all. What would happen? Well, the poles would never get any sunlight. They would be in eternal twilight. And as a result of that, great, gigantic, huge glaciers would form in the North and South Poles. And what they've done the calculations, they would actually squeeze the Earth, like you would take a ball and squeeze it like this, and it would bulge out in the middle. That would cause volcanoes and earthquakes and all kinds of problems by itself. But there would be no growing seasons in the North or South. And on the equator, it would be so hot because of that bulge that people couldn't live around the equator. They couldn't sustain life. And so that doesn't work. Well, what if it was tilted more than 23 degrees? Maybe 45 degrees, 35 degrees. If that had occurred, winters would be far more severe, summers would be far more severe, and life would not be possible. 23 degrees is just about right. So this first point, we talked about just six constants. Now let's get to the second point. These constants prove that our world was designed. And we'll get into the odds of that in just a second. But these constants, the fact that they all line up just perfectly within very narrow parameters, prove that the Earth was designed. We've only mentioned six constants, but guess how many there are? There's 122. And you take any one of them off, and life would not exist. 122 constants had to come together to make life possible on this earth. Each is finely tuned as what we've just talked about. Astrophysicist Hugh Ross, he's a PhD from the University of Toronto, calculated the possibility that these 120 plus constants would come together by chance on one planet. Now, first you have to know how many planets there are in the universe to do the calculations. So he assumed the number of planets in the universe is 10 to the 22nd power. Now, for those of you who've forgotten, you know, high school math or college math, that's 10 with 22 zeros. That is the number of planets in the universe. 10 with 22 zeros. Lots of planets. So you have lots of opportunities for this to happen by chance or by accident. Guess what? The chance of all 122 constants occurring in one planet with those numbers of planets, Ross calculated that to be 1 in 10 to the 138th power. That's 10 with 138 zeros. One chance against all of that. So you scratch your head and say, well, okay, what is 10 to the 138th power? I mean, what does that actually mean? Well, let's put it another way. If you took all the atoms in the universe, meaning the atoms in our bodies, the atoms in all of the humans on the earth, the atoms of all the animals, all the plants, the atoms in the earth itself, the atoms in the atmosphere, then you took the atoms in all of the planets in our solar system, plus the atoms in the sun, and then you took all of the stars and planets in the Milky Way, that's 100 billion plus stars, and all of the atoms and all of those stars and all of the gas and all of the dust and all of the suns in the Milky Way. And then you took all of the atoms that are in all of the other constellations, all of the other stars in the universe. You see, there's 100 billion Milky Ways out there, each with 100 to 200 billion stars. If you took all of those atoms and you said, okay, how many is that? That's only 10 to the 70th power. So what that tells us is the chance of these 120 plus constants to come together in one planet is one chance in twice the number of atoms in the entire universe. What is that saying? The chance of that happening is zero. Absolutely zero. It's like saying life happened on Earth by chance is equivalent to saying you built a Boeing 747 resulted from a tornado going through a junkyard. It is impossible. It is beyond calculation, as William Paley said. Cosmologist Ed Harrison, he's a well-known author, he's written many books on cosmology, says, quote, "Here is the cosmological proof of the existence of God, the design argument of Paley, about the watch, updated and refurbished." University of Chicago physicist Michael Turner, commenting on just one of these constants, not one we've talked about, but one of the 122, that's the rate of the expansion of the universe. The Big Bang started from nothing. All matter exploded and energy exploded from that one point and has been expanding ever since. It's kind of a good analogy. You had a cannonball, you shoot it straight up. Well, we have gravity on the earth. The cannonball will start very fast, but slow down, slow down, slow down, and then start to come back to the earth due to gravity. Well, the explosion of the universe had to be just as finely tuned. Otherwise, it would collapse in on itself, or otherwise it would coast off where we wouldn't see anything. We would be all alone. So let me quote what Michael Turner, this physicist, says. Quote, To get a universe that is that has expanded as long as ours has, without either collapsing or having its matter coast away, would have required extraordinarily fine tuning. Just what we've been talking about. The odds of achieving this would be the same as throwing a dart at the most distant star, 13 million light years away, and hitting a bullseye 1 millimeter in diameter. Those are the odds, just of this one constant, the expansion of the universe. Then one more quote under the second point is Nobel laureate Arno Penzias. We talked about him back in March. He was the co-discoverer of the afterglow of the Big Bang, the radiation from that initial explosion. That has been confirmed and reconfirmed and re-reconfirmed over the years. It is there. It is real. He says, quote, then he won a Nobel Prize for it. Astronomy leads us to a unique event. Notice what he says, the scientist. A universe which was created out of nothing. And that was a huge leap for scientists to understand. And delicately balanced to provide exactly the conditions required to support life. In the presence of an absurdly improbable accident, the observations of modern science seem to suggest an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. Scientists with an open mind are starting to see that this did not happen by accident. Let's go to Psalm 147 and verse 4 and see what God says. Psalm 147 and verse 4. God says that he has powers we cannot comprehend. Psalm 147 and verse 4. It says, he, referring to God Almighty, he tells the number of the stars. Not only that, he calls them all by their names. Verse 5, great is our Lord and of great power. His understanding is infinite. Absolutely. To make all this happen, it cannot happen by accident. It must have been created by a being that has infinite wisdom, understanding, and an infinite mind. Okay, let's get to the third point. We're building up a case here. The third point is that God says we can know him by looking at his creation. You know, the fact is, many truths about God can be known by what he's done. And guess what? Those things that he's done, we can observe. We can see with our own eyes. And shame on us if we don't do that. Notice what David wrote 3,000 years ago. Let's go to Psalm 19 and verse 1. David knew this. God inspired him to write this. And David believed this 3,000 years ago. Scientists today are just starting to get a glimpse of what David knew 3,000 years ago. Psalm 19 verse 1. We sing a song, a psalm about this. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. We see it. He goes on, day unto day utters speech, meaning God's handiwork, and night unto night shows knowledge, meaning the knowledge of God, the Creator. Verse 3, there is no speech nor language where their voice, meaning God's handiwork, is not heard. We see it all over. God's creative ability is on display everywhere. Dorothy and I were looking at the sunrise the other day, and you look at that sunrise and you think, what a magnificent God we have. And no two sunrises are ever the same. And yet God gives us this beautiful thing every morning. Every morning. Let's look to see what Isaiah wrote 300 years after David. Isaiah 40, we'll begin in verse 22. Isaiah 40 and verse 22, written about 2,700 years ago. Isaiah knew things that medieval scholars didn't know. Isaiah 40 and verse 22. He that sits upon the circle of the earth. Wow, the earth is round. It's not flat. And even today, we have flat earthers that believe the earth is flat. If you can imagine that, it's a circle, but it's a flat circle. It is he that sits upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers. That's how God looks at our scientists today. And all of us, really, because we're just jumping around on the earth doing whatever we do. That stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent to dwell in. You see, God not only revealed that the earth was round 700 years before the birth of Christ, but he also says God created all of this and spread it out as a curtain for us to see every night, once the sun goes down. Jumping to verse 25, now God starts to speak. To whom then will you liken me? Or shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Verse 26, lift up your eyes on high and behold, who has created these things that brings out their host by number and calls them all by names? By the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one fails. God is the power and the intelligence behind all of this. Let's go back to Psalm 97 now, and let's look at verse 6. Another scripture that says we can know God by lifting up our eyes to the heavens. Psalm 97 and verse 6. We're told the heavens declare his righteousness, and all the people see his glory. If we would only take the time to do that and marvel at it. But the point here, this Psalm 97 verse 6 tells us that the heavens are there for a reason. And one of those reasons is to convince humankind that this didn't happen by accident. And there is a supreme intelligence by it all. God is saying to mankind, look up and look at what I have made and see me, if you will only do that. So God is telling us that we can know him by what he has made. Now let's go to point four. We've seen, talk briefly about everything that has to come together in a planned way with very tight tolerances to make life possible. So what point four is, how do the atheists respond to this overwhelming evidence? I mean, what do they do? How can they continue to be an atheist in spite of all this evidence? You see, there is no chance that the universe, this earth, happened by accident. And yet, scientists, atheistic scientists, have developed a theory in attempt to answer this question. And that theory is called the multiple universe theory. And it states that there are an infinite number of universes. Therefore, ours happens to be, since there's an infinite number, it can overcome all of these odds, ours happens to be the only one that all of the criterion comes together. The only one. And it relies on the fact that an infinite number of universes. Therefore, as I said, then the odds can go away if there's an infinite number. Now, what is the evidence against this theory? And I want you to, you're going to have to screw your mind down tight on the second one. The first one, what is the evidence against this theory? The first one is that there's absolutely no evidence for it. Meaning, there is no evidence whatsoever that there are any other universes. Ever. Nobody's seen it. Nobody's measured it. It is all speculation on the part of theorists. That's the first one. Now, the second one, we're going to need to think hard about this. The second reason that this can't happen is focus with me here. You cannot have an unlimited number of limited things. You can't have an unlimited number of limited things. It is an impossibility. In other words, you cannot have an infinite number, unlimited number, an infinite number of finite things. Finite means something has a beginning and something has an end. It is finite. You see, because a finite thing has a beginning and an end. So therefore, you cannot have an unlimited number of things that have a beginning and an end. Now, you need to chew on this for a while and think about this. The best way I know of to understand this is by asking, okay, who are our parents? We know our parents. And some are blessed to know their grandparents. And even some are blessed to know their great-grandparents. So they kind of know where they come. So here, this generation begets this generation begets this generation. And you see, all humans are finite, as we obviously know. We have a beginning and we have an end. So you can go back and just say, well, this family beget that family, and it just goes back, 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 back. But there must be a someone to create a being who had a beginning. There must be an eternal being to create a being that has a beginning. There must be an eternal being to create a universe that had a beginning, because it came from nothing. Well, did another universe beget our universe? That doesn't happen. So when you have a finite thing and you say there's an infinite number of them, that can't be. Because ultimately you come back to what is the first finite thing? The first thing that had a beginning and an end. The very first one didn't create itself. So there has to be an infinite being, a being that doesn't have a beginning and doesn't have an end, to create a finite being. This cannot go on indefinitely. And we know humanly we come back to Adam and Eve and God and Jesus Christ. So if there is no infinite or eternal being, if there's no God, there's no infinite or eternal being, how did the first finite being come into existence? You can't explain it because it's an impossibility. The only possible conclusion is no being created God, because God himself is eternal. That is the only conclusion that we can draw. Let's go to Deuteronomy 33 and verse 27. This basically says it all. Deuteronomy 33 and verse 27. Notice how God is described. Deuteronomy 33 and verse 27 says, "The eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms," his everlasting arms, everlasting, no beginning, no end. You see, we know, we absolutely know for a fact that physical life hasn't existed forever. Therefore, spiritual life must have. That is the only conclusion that can be drawn. The universe had a beginning and it had an end. Therefore, you cannot have an infinite number of them. Because who created the first universe that has a beginning and has an end? Astronomer Fred Hoyle, who opposed the Big Bang, he coined the term Big Bang, and he meant it in a derisive way. He said, "You guys, this theory, you just, it's like a big fireworks going off. It's just a Big Bang." And he was deriding scientists. And he did so for several decades. And he just couldn't accept that everything started from one explosion and there was nothing before that. He believed that the universe was eternal and not a God. But he finally concluded the following, quote, this was not long before his death, "A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics as well as the chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. None. Everything is planned. Nothing happened by accident." Now, he didn't know who the superintelligence was because he wasn't called, but he did recognize the fine-tuning in every aspect of the universe. And that fine-tuning required intelligence. And so multiple universes cannot, does not, never will explain creation. And never can explain creation without a creator. Now let's go to the fifth and final point. Today we see Satan is doing all he can to get people's focus away from God as our creator. He is doing everything he can to get our focus away from God as our creator. We know Satan has deceived the whole world, Revelation 12 and verse 9. But one of his greatest successes in modern society is convincing humans there is no God. 200 years ago in England and the United States, everybody believed there was a God. There was no question. But look at the society today in the Western world. People don't know. They're agnostic. They're atheistic because of what Satan has been able to do. He's removed God from our government. He's removed God from our schools. He's forbidden the teaching about God's existence. He's promoted atheism and evolution, and it has permeated modern society. And he's provoked scholars and teachers and intellectuals to ridicule those who believe in God, basically calling us uneducated, uninformed, we don't know. We're up here, you're down here, you're just kind of, you don't get it. You don't have the intelligence to get it like we do. George Will, who is my favorite commentator, he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning conservative political commentator. He has a column once a week in our paper. This is really funny. He says this, quote, "Soon the American Civil Liberties Union, or some similar faction of litigious secularism, will file suit against NASA, charging that the Hubble Space Telescope unconstitutionally gives comfort to the religiously inclined." That's how bad it's got. You know, he's poking fun, but he's not far away from the truth. You see, Satan is attempting to cover up all evidence that God exists. Let's just talk about one example under this point. And that, we've talked about it in the past a couple of times, but that's light pollution in our towns and our cities. Light pollution, when you have, you know, street lights and neon signs and all of this kind of other stuff, there's so much light on the ground that you cannot see the sky. You just can't. Now, if you go out in the middle of nowhere with the naked eye, you can see about 2,500 stars. And you can see the band of the Milky Way go across the sky, if you can get away where there is no light. But because of light pollution, if you're in a suburb of a big city, not in the big city, just a suburb, you can only see, instead of 2,500, you can only see 200 to 300 stars. 200 to 300. And if you are in a typical city, Seattle, or downtown, even in our town probably, you can see fewer than a dozen stars. Now, I've walked down the canyons of New York City, where you have these giant skyscrapers, and all you see around you is stuff built by men. And if you want to see the sky, you got to look, you know, almost break your neck looking straight up, and you might see a tiny little patch of black where no skyscraper is there, but you certainly can't see any stars. The only thing you can see is the moon, maybe, or maybe Venus, but that's it. And the sad thing is only 1 in 3 Americans have ever seen the Milky Way. 1 in 3 have ever seen it. And, you know, with the naked eye I'm talking about. And it's only those that live in very remote areas where there is no light pollution. So Satan is, this is just one example of Satan, you know, he's infiltrated our schools, the government, schools of higher learning, graduate schools, all of that to promote the fact that God doesn't exist. And then he's tried to cover it up so you can't see the sky, you can't see the heavens. But look at what God said again, about 3,000 years ago in Psalm 14, the Psalm of David. Psalm 14 will begin in verse 1. We'll just read verse 1. Psalm 14 and verse 1. Notice this. God says, "The fool." Now let's just stop there. What does he mean by fool? The Hebrew has two meanings. And they comprise the whole spectrum, these two meanings. One is stupid, meaning somebody doesn't have the mental intelligence to come to a right conclusion. The other meaning is evil, meaning he does not want to come to the right conclusion because his mind is evil. Stupid, evil. The fool has said in his heart, "There is no God." They, meaning these fools, are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that does good. What are these abominable works, at least in the context of what we're talking about today? Is these works, abominable works, are attempting to convince humankind there is no God. Abominable works, denying God. And to remove God from every facet of our society. That's why, you know, notice what Christ said a couple of thousand years ago in Matthew 11 and verse 29. You see, this is a key for all of us, for mankind in general, but for all of us. Christ said, Matthew 11 and verse 29, he says, "Take my yoke upon you," but notice these next four words, "and learn of me." Learn about me. The New King James says, "Learn from me." The New Living Translation says, "Let me teach you." And so what Christ is saying, if you will just look up, I could teach you all kinds of things about my Father and about me. I could teach you all kinds of things about my plan of salvation. And that's just by looking up, not to mention God's Word. That is the source of all our knowledge and understanding. But God and Christ teach us that if we will but just look up to the heavens, we can overcome all this last point here of Satan trying to convince us that God doesn't exist. So let's conclude now. Regarding human life, human existence, the only possible conclusions are two. Either no one created something out of nothing, or someone created something out of nothing. That's the only logical conclusion, because we know this universe at some point in the distant past didn't exist. So it came out of nothing. So either no one created it, or someone created it. Only possible conclusions. And since we can reject the first, and accept the second, the only person, the only being that could create this would be someone of supreme intelligence to fine-tune everything that we see all around us. This is why 48 years ago in this month, 48 years ago, 1968, something unique happened. And this is the crew, referring to the crew of Apollo 8. And I remember this like it was yesterday, because I was in the Air Force, and I was being called at the same time. And the crew of Apollo 8, Frank Borman and James Lovell, who commanded the crew that we talked about in the beginning, and William Anders, that spacecraft was the first spacecraft to leave the orbit of the Earth. Prior to that time, we had just sent men orbiting around the Earth. This was the first spacecraft to leave Earth. To leave the orbit of the Earth in an attempt to circle the moon. Weren't ready to land on it yet, but to go out and circle the moon and come back. And I can remember watching television, live television at that time. NASA, you know, partly for PR purposes, but also just to record the event, had powerful Earth-based telescopes with television cameras attached to them, rudimentary by today's standards, but it still worked. They positioned a telescope and a camera just to the point where they lit the rockets to blast this out of Earth orbit. And I can remember you could see it just silently going through the sky, and then all of a sudden that rocket lit. And then it started accelerating faster and faster and faster until the point you could just see the rear end of the rocket. You could just see the flames of the rocket until it disappeared. And I remember thinking at that time how lonely these men must have been, you know, to leave the Earth, to look back in the mirror, so to speak, and see this beautiful ball receding, and they're going where no human has ever gone. And they must have just felt very lonely. But they had a successful mission, and they rounded the far side of the moon for the very first time. And when you go on the back side of the moon, you lose radio contact because of the moon itself blocks the signals. And so I can remember watching it, and we waited and waited, and I think it was several minutes. I can't remember exactly how much. But they came around the other side, and for the first time in human history, they saw an Earth rise. Not a moon rise, but an Earth rise. And they were awestruck by what they saw. And guess what they did, these three guys? Now, they had planned it, yes. But they were every one of them was a scientist in his own right, an engineer in his own right. And they knew what they were going to see, but it was so awesome that it took their breath away. And guess what they did, if you remember, if you were alive at that time? They quoted the first 10 verses of Genesis. And I can remember hearing that and thinking, you know, here are these three guys, so farther away from Earth than any humans have ever been, and they round the far side of the moon, and the first thing they quote is Genesis. And I was coming into the church, and man, that had an impression on me. It was the most watched television program up to that point in time. And they quoted those verses, and then, yes, it was about Christmas, and you know, about Christmas time, but they signed off by saying, to the people of the good earth. And so the point I'm making is, you know, the fact that God says, if you'll just look up and see my creation, these three men rounded the moon and saw God's creation, the most beautiful, unlike any other globe that has ever been seen by telescopes or anything, this beautiful blue globe with the white clouds and the continents floating out in space. They were so awestruck by God's power and by God's might that they quoted that. And, you know, the fact is that most of the astronauts, there's an article in our paper today, most of the astronauts were religious. If they weren't religious before, they were religious afterward. And they, because of what they saw and what they experienced. You see, in these last days, God has provided so much evidence that He exists. We didn't have this evidence 100 years ago, 50 years ago. Took it on faith in many cases. But now there is so much evidence, the tables have turned 180 degrees. The atheists have to accept their doctrine on faith because the evidence supports a supreme being. And it takes boundless, blind faith to be an atheist. Before this is all over, God is going to be able to say to humankind, I showed you, you knew, you didn't accept it, you ignored it, you poo-pooed it, but it was there all this time. And we come to Romans 1 and verse 20, last scripture. Because God writes this down, what He's going to say to them. And what He's saying to all mankind today. Romans 1 verse 20. I'm going to read it out of the NLT. That has a very interesting translation that is just as accurate as the King James. Romans 1 verse 20. From the time the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky and all that God made. They can clearly see His invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature. Get this. So they have no excuse whatsoever for not knowing God. The evidence is clear. The evidence is there. Verse 21. Yes, they knew God, but they wouldn't worship Him as God or even give Him thanks. And they began to think up foolish ideas of what God was like. I might add, foolish ideas like evolution. The result was that their minds became dark and confused. Claiming to be wise, they became utter fools instead. Atheists today. Verse 23. And instead of worshiping the glorious, ever-living God, they worshiped idols made to look like mere people or birds and animals and snakes. And today, rather than doing that, you know, we feel like we're so advanced as human beings. Today, what scientists do, they worship the human mind. Because on the evolutionary scale, on the evolutionary ladder, at the peak of the ladder, at the top of the pyramid, are human beings. We're the most advanced. And guess what? The human mind is the epitome of all evolution. And so what scientists do today, instead of worshiping God, they worship something God has created. Now, back in Egypt, they worshiped something made out of wood or stone. But today, they worship the human mind and saying that is everything. That is the ultimate. Verse 24. So God let them go ahead and do whatever shameful things their hearts desired. Verse 25. Instead of believing what they knew was the truth about God, they deliberately chose to believe lies. Atheism, evolution. So they worship the things God made, but not the Creator Himself, who is to be praised forever. Today, all too many willingly ignore the evidence that God exists, and it's right in front of their eyes. So we need to be thankful that God in these end times has revealed it to us. And the evidence is overwhelming. The evidence is right there. The evidence that He exists and that He is supreme over all.